Good evening, everyone. My name is Gary Joyner of the Texas Farm Bureau, and I will be your moderator tonight. Welcome to the Texas Farm Bureau Teletown Hall on cattle industry issues. A few quick orientation items. If at any time you'd like to ask a question, please press zero on your phone's keypad. You will be transferred to a Texas Farm Bureau representative who will take down your question and position it for our speakers. Please know if you are waiting to connect with our representative to ask your question, you still will be able to hear the event while on hold. We will do our best to answer as many questions as possible tonight. I would like to begin by welcoming Texas Farm Bureau President Russell Boehning. President Boehning, thank you for joining us tonight from Wilson County.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I think the timing of tonight's Teletown Hall is critical. We're all on this call because we're concerned. Of course, we're concerned about our own operations and our businesses, but we're also concerned about the future of the beef industry and the beef cattle production in Texas and across this country. This global pandemic has injected a never-before-seen uncertainty into our cattle and beef markets. We've all seen a surge in beef demand that has emptied grocery store aisles, meat aisles, but there's no lack of supply. And despite a rise in retail prices in some areas, we all know that prices paid to cattle ranchers have fallen around 25%. So what does all this mean? But more importantly, why is this happening? What can we anticipate as we go forward? These are just a few of the questions that we hope to discuss and answer tonight. When it comes to these things, we know that there's no easy answers. But we think we've had the right people with us tonight to help us understand the dynamics and the factors that have brought us to this point. We all know that the hardships created by the virus add to an already difficult year in Texas agriculture. Many of us are battling the impacts of the pandemic on our own farm and ranch, while at the same time committing ourselves to feeding our country at a time when food security matters the most. We all know that you could all be doing a lot of different things right now, but you're here. You're here tonight. You're on this call. We want to thank you for taking that time to participate in being a part of our Teletown Hall meeting. With that, Gary, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much, President Boehning. As a reminder, if you do have a question, you may press zero on your phone's keypad. You'll be transferred to a Texas Farm Bureau representative who will take down your question and position it for our speakers. If you are waiting to connect with a representative to ask your question, you still will be able to hear the event while on hold, and we'll be getting to those questions for too much longer. I would like to now introduce our three speakers and give them an opportunity to provide some opening remarks. Our three speakers are Dr. David Anderson of the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and Scott Bennett and Michael Nephew of the American Farm Bureau Federation. We'll begin with Dr. Anderson with the cattle market overview. Dr. David Anderson is a professor and extension economist in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Texas A&M University. His extension education and research activities are in livestock and food products marketing and agricultural policy. He is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Livestock and Food Products Marketing Economist. Prior to returning to Texas A&M in 1996, he was a livestock economist at the Livestock Marketing Information Center for 2 years. Dr. Anderson, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be with all of you tonight. I'll spend a few minutes talking a few comments about the cattle market. And I guess I want to start with sort of the understatement of the month, and that is times are not normal. And you can kind of pick your term for that, but not only are they not normal throughout our economy, but, you know, that should tell us we probably shouldn't expect normal markets in the cattle market either, and that's exactly where we are. So I'd like to talk about this from kind of an overview of two different parts. I want to talk a little about the cash market, and then I'll make a few comments about the futures market, and that, you know, that may direct some of our questions of where we're going, because certainly I hear a lot of these questions from folks all the time also. So, you know, if I jump in and talk about the cash market a little bit, I think I think one of the things I would point out is that, I think it's fair to say our cattle prices were already under pressure before the coronavirus hit. Before all the shutdowns started, we've had a very large beef production the first quarter of the year. In fact, beef production was about 6% larger than it was the first quarter last year. So we already had prices going down. But I think it's worth thinking about this from the top or the bottom, depending on your view. But if we start at the grocery stores, any of y'all that went to a grocery store, that's about the closest thing folks in town are going to see to a stampede, I think. Basically, restaurants all over the country have shut down or reduced themselves to takeout only, those that are surviving. Folks started having shelter in place and shutdown orders and all kinds of stuff all over the country, and folks just plain stampeded to the grocery stores and bought everything in sight. And I'll tell you, even at my store, where I go to a shop, folks even bought chicken livers and gizzards. So I'll use that as an example of perhaps some desperate times for some folks because they even bought those items. They bought everything. And so if we think about that and think about how our markets work, roughly 50% of our food we consume away from home. We consume in restaurants. About 50% we consume at home. And so we've shut down a significant portion of our total food consumption. And I think if we extend that, think about beef as well, and other meats too, but about beef as well, restaurants already placed their orders for meat. They have that stuff in stock. Grocery stores have planned on their sales, and that starts a good 6 weeks out or more, planning on stocking the shelves, and suddenly, they had a stampede of folks that bought everything in sight. They had to jump into the spot market and buy stuff at wholesale just to get the aisles, the meat counter back in shape. And so we saw a 25% increase in the source beef, box beef cutout. It went from $2.05 to $2.57 a week. And it reflects just plain shifting our entire supply chain away from restaurants and to grocery stores. I should point out, too, if you look this morning, the choice box beef cutout was down to $2.26. So we're seeing some adjustment as it's coming back down as the stores are getting full again. And that volatility in that market extends itself to the Fed cattle market. If you watching Fed cattle, I'm talking cash. We went from $1.12 to $1.05. The flood at the grocery stores hit. We jumped to $1.12. We jumped to $1.20. We're back to $1.12. In fact, there was some Fed cattle sold yesterday at $1.11. And so that volatility, that rise in the wholesale market, that demand for beef and expanding at the grocery stores has extended itself to the Fed cattle market as well. That volatility is in the cattle and calves, too, and really where we're starting to see significant pressure and significantly lower prices on our calves and our feeder cattle. But I want to come back to that feeder cattle and calves in just a minute. I think we've got to talk about the futures market. And, I've often, when I talk this or when we think about the futures market, I like to remind people, the futures market for live cattle, the Fed cattle contract, and cash cattle, those are two different markets, but they're related. And if we think about it, cattle trading today, Fed cattle that sold today are today's conditions. The futures market reflects what buyers and sellers think is going to be out there in the future. So one's today and one's in the future. But if you look at this collapse in the futures market, and I say collapse, and when I'm talking the live cattle, that Fed cattle contract for April, that thing has gone from about 125 back in January to 80 bucks. We've had some comeback in the last couple of days. In fact, we were up the limit today. It got us to about 88. But I think it's important to look at what people in the market, in the futures market, are looking at. Both hedgers and speculators, I think the futures market is priced in three things. One is that we are in a recession. and that it's going to get worse. So I think we've priced in one recession or worse. And you think about what a recession does, falling income, rising unemployment. Consumers change what they buy at the meat case. They buy fewer steaks and they buy more hamburger. And that changes our values of what we're producing. The second thing that I think the futures market is priced in going forward is the probability that we will see a major beef packing plant close because of the effects of coronavirus, that they get such a widespread outbreak in their workforce that they're unable to operate and have to close. I think that's the second thing that is priced in. And I think the third thing that's priced in is that we just don't have a lot of beef production. And we've got a lot of pork and chicken production, too. We're estimating that we're going to have a record of all of those. So if we think about that futures market, why is it down, beaten down so far? Why is the basis so large between cash and futures? Cash markets reflecting today, and we still have demand for beef. We still have packing plants that are demanding cattle to run them through the system, get beef out to grocery stores. We have continued to have a very good beef demand profile in the U.S. Over the last 4 or 5 years, I would argue we've had the best demand for beef in the last 25 years. And so, you know, if we think about those underlying conditions, I think that's what the futures market is priced in, and that's why we see such a large difference to cash. So while we're seeing simply lower calf prices and feeder cattle prices, you know, I think that's where they really are being affected by the futures market for live cattle. And the question I pose is, you know, what would you want to pay for feeders or for calves today to finish in August? When you think about that uncertainty of August or October, what's this recession going to be like? How do we come out of it? Where do we go from here? I think that's forcing those our calf market down, our feeder cattle market down, is a heck of a lot of uncertainty and volatility about where we go from here. And so with that, sort of as a quick overview, I think I've probably used plenty of time. Hopefully I've set up a few questions, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues, and I look forward to getting some questions from y'all. Again, thank you very much for having me with y'all tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. We appreciate that very much, and we will continue now with Scott Bennett and Michael Nephew with a federal initiatives update. Scott Bennett serves as the American Farm Bureau Federation's Director of Congressional Relations. His issue portfolio is comprised of livestock and related issues, including GIPSA, cell-based proteins, gene editing, and mandatory price reporting. Mr. Bennett has been with the American Farm Bureau Federation since October of 2018. His prior experience includes serving as legislative director for former House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte. Mr. Bennett, welcome to our program.
I'd just like to welcome everyone this evening. Thank you for the opportunity to join you, and thank you to Texas Farm Bureau for the hard work that you all do on behalf of your farmers and ranchers. I'll do a breakdown kind of the political atmosphere that agriculture and particularly livestock agriculture finds itself in. The CARES Act, I think everyone knows this is the $2.2 trillion package that was passed by Congress, signed by the President. This is the package that has garnered so much media attention and is part of the relief effort that the government's decided is necessary for our economy. As we look at what's in that CARES Act, $24 to $25 billion has been set aside in that $2.2 trillion for USDA. $14 billion of that is set to replenish the Commodity Credit Corporation. As many people are aware of, the market facilitation payments that were made to farmers that were affected by Chinese or the lack of Chinese trade, those payments came out of the CCC. It depleted it by about half, and an additional $14 billion from this CARES Act came into play and replenished the CCC back to $30 billion. $9 billion was also given to USDA for COVID-19 aid and response. That money is used at the discretion of the Secretary of Agriculture, and many people have seen that specialty crops and livestock have access particularly to that $9 billion. It's not limited to those two sectors of agriculture, but that will be, from a livestock perspective, especially where a lot of focus is put into as we try and find aid for farmers and ranchers that have cattle, hogs, chicken, lambs, and turkey. Now, the big question that everybody wants to know the answer to is, you know, how much will I be paid, and when will I be paid as a cattle producer? I wish I had an eight ball that I could shake and give you that answer to, but quite frankly, the answer to it is it's a work in progress. As you can imagine, USDA has been drinking out of a fire hose here with all of the concerns from every aspect of agriculture. This is a work in progress. At American Farm Bureau, we've advocated that we need this relief now. We need it fast, but we also want it to be thought out and strategic and equitable to essentially all different sectors of the industry. And bear with me, my remarks today are specifically tailored more to cattle producers and the cattle industry more than other proteins. We've encouraged USDA, again, to construct a program that's equitable to all sectors. We think it's imperative, and we really focused on allowing relief to come to the cow-calf producer. As we all know, the cattle industry is very dynamic between the cow and calf producer, the backgrounder, the stocker, the feeder. They are all in need of relief, but when we look at the cow-calf producer, who typically has a smaller herd and one that is not going to have maybe risk management tools in place, if they were to sell their cattle in this climate, they're going to see a loss, and we need to make sure that that is mitigated as much as possible through the funding of this $9 billion. That's my summary, essentially, of the CARES Act and what we've seen. Many people in the news have talked about, this phase four or the next package. We will anticipate Speaker Pelosi of the House to initiate that when Congress returns at the end of April. We are already working with members of Congress and both the Senate and House Ag Committees on what potential relief, if needed, in a fourth phase of COVID-19 relief would look like. Shifting gears a little bit and away from the politics and more to the cattle industry, as Dr. Anderson mentioned, we're in very volatile times. American Farm Bureau remains in constant communications with the major packers, the big four. I talk to them almost daily. I have daily phone calls with Undersecretary of Ag Marketing Service Greg Ibaugh, the former Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Nebraska. He is very much aware of the concerns that American Farm Bureau has. But I would want to emphasize the fact that it is absolutely crucial that we keep these packing plants open. There is some heartburn in the countryside of the packer margin, and I sympathize with that my father and two uncles and a grandfather make a living in the cow-calf industry in the southside part of Virginia. That's how my family makes a living. So I am there with you. The packer margin has been something instilled in me my entire childhood and growing up that something paid very close attention to. However, it's imperative that these plants remain open. We've seen these plants slip off in their production. That's due to a multitude of factors, and our economist, Michael Nethy, will really extrapolate on that to some degree. But as we see these plants slip in their capacity to pack, and we look at the JBS plant in Sauterton, Pennsylvania, a couple Tyson plants, I believe, in Indiana, have now shut down. I just want the public to know this is not a food safety issue. These plants are made to be disinfected. They are disinfected on a daily basis, if not between shifts, to kill Listeria, E. coli, Salmonella. Those same protocols without change can kill this COVID-19 virus. In the case of the Sauterton, Pennsylvania plant, it was actually the management team, the essential staff taken to run that plant that fell ill to this virus, and that was the need to shut that plant down. I think that is something worth noting. It wasn't necessarily the critical mass of the line workers, but instead it was the staff that it takes to run the plant and know the ins and outs of it. And to kind of shift gears again, back to the political side, there's been some recent engagements by politicians across the country on this various issue. On this very issue, Colin Peterson, the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, wrote a letter to the Department of Justice and to the CFTC on his concern for volatility and potential manipulation in these cattle markets. He has risen it to the highest level through a letter from his office as the House Ag Chairman. We have, at American Farm Bureau, planned to send a letter and thanking him for looking after that. We have articulated that same concern to USDA multiple times through official communication. And then I'd also like to mention that there has been a congressional letter signed by several members in the Texas delegation, and I believe both senators, to USDA articulating the concern and the need for cattle producers to be made right in the disbursement of these funds that have come to USDA through the CARES Act. So with that, I'm excited to take any questions that folks may have. I encourage everyone to stay safe, and last but certainly not least, eat your fair share of beef. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. We appreciate your good comments, and we look forward to asking some good questions of you and our panelists in just a few minutes. We've already received several good questions, and we appreciate that. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0 on your phone's keypad, and you'll be visiting with the Texas Farm Bureau representative to get those questions prepared for our speaker's consideration. We continue with Michael Nephew. Michael Nephew he serves as an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. His issue portfolio consists of livestock and dairy markets, farm bill, and federal crop insurance, among others. He joined the American Farm Bureau Federation as an economist in May of 2018. He comes to AFBF from Informa Economics Agribusiness Group, where he was an analyst charged with conducting policy and economic research and analysis in several fields, including agriculture, agricultural risk management, transportation, and renewable energy. Mr. Nephew, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to some folks from Texas. I'm originally from Brenham, Texas, so it's always great to get to talk to the Texas folks down at Texas Farm Bureau. But like I said, I'm one of the economists for American Farm Bureau. I primarily handle livestock issues. And I would just like to expand a little bit on some of the efforts that Scott had spoken about what American Farm Bureau is doing on behalf of American ranchers and cattle producers in this very volatile time. One thing that we have absolutely heard from all the members, this is Dr. Anderson alluded to it, Scott kind of talked about it a little bit, but we get a lot of concerns from the producers about market volatility. We hear a lot about the spread between cutout and the cattle prices, that might have spread cutout, and, you know, we get it. We understand that it's very frustrating to watch the cutout rise so dramatically while watching cash and futures prices drop as much as they did. So one thing that we have been doing at AFBF, and Scott again alluded to it, he said he's been in contact with packers. Well, we've also been in contact with the folks who regulate the packers and the folks who regulate the futures markets. So We've been in close contact with the CFTC. We've spoken with many of the staff there about actions that they are taking in order to monitor these markets. You know, while we haven't necessarily seen any direct issues about, you know, you hear it all the time, market manipulation, whenever you see the cutout rise the way it did, there's always some frustrations by people. So CFTC has heard those concerns. They're definitely on it. We actually have a call set up here tomorrow between the American Farm Bureau President, Zippy Duvall, and the chairman of the CFTC, Chairman Taubert. So, again, we are very vocal about making the concerns of you all, y'all, all of our producers, making those concerns heard to the people in charge. We also have had conversations with the CME. Again, Dr. Anderson talked about the volatility, the just collapse of the April futures contract, other futures contract. This has been a real difficult time for risk management. It's just been a roller coaster. Thank God I don't have to be in charge of forecasting because I have no idea how I really pull any of that together. So, again, we've had those conversations with the folks in charge. Some other issues, we've been working very closely with the Livestock Marketing Association, LMA. We've been hearing a lot of concerns about cattle auctions. You know, we're seeing drastically reduced volumes. Some cases you're hearing about auctions having to take place about half as often as they used to. We've heard complaints about, you know, some of the packers call up an auction and said, you know, with everything going on with COVID-19 and coronavirus, we're just not going to show up. And in that case, they said, no, the big guys are showing up. They're not even going to hold the auction. That's not a workable option for producers to have cattle that they got to take to market. That's something that, you know, we got to work with. There's also something that, you know, in our conversations with CFTC that was brought up to us directly, we've heard reports of issues with some local municipalities not fully understanding that agriculture is an essential service that should be allowed to operate under the current conditions. There have been some reports of local municipalities trying to shut down auctions, saying that, you know, that's a gathering of more than 10 people. You know, when we brought this up to CFTC, they said, let us know. If you're having issues, all you producers out there, if you're having issues with something like this, we need to know about it so we can bring it up to the regulators so they can really communicate to those folks that this is an essential service. These markets have to be functioning properly in order to ensure that this nation is fed. I'll also talk a little bit, Scott had alluded to it, is these packing plants potentially closing down. You heard about the solder bin one in Pennsylvania. I know yesterday there were, it's not just beef, pork, other animal proteins are suffering quite a bit as well. Poultry in Georgia, Iowa saw a few pork plants closed down as well as a beef plant. These are temporary closures. It's not the same as what we saw last August with the Tyson fire. This is short-term, smaller closures that are kind of rolling, and that's where all this uncertainty is coming from because nobody really knows how much this is going to happen. We're also hearing reports of some of those packing plants, the line speed slowing down dramatically. I've heard several reports of JBS going down as low as 50% capacity is where they've been on some plants out in Colorado. Others, you keep hearing regularly that they're not operating more than 70-80%. So I think that's going to be putting some downward pressure on cash prices. Is, you know, you're essentially having an oversupply of fed cattle whenever you have packing plants that can't operate at normal capacity, and that's just going to create another tricky situation that we got to work our way through. Another thing that, again, Dr. Anderson talked about, that recessionary pressure being pressed into the futures markets, that to me is the scariest. We're very likely, you know, you see every week we have millions upon millions of more Americans being put out of work overnight. Nobody really saw this coming, and beef, in my opinion, is a necessity, but it is a little bit of a luxury product in that it's a superior product and that it's a higher price than some of the other animal proteins. And when you have a recession and consumers are getting wage cuts, many are losing their jobs, they're having to choose how to spend those dollars very specifically. beef doesn't always do that great in a recession, and I think that's going to be a demand pressure that's going to be really difficult to overcome. But just to keep us on time, I think we'll close up by saying that, again, Scott talked about all the efforts we're doing at AFPF. The Texas Farm Bureau folks are fantastic. They're working every day, working for you guys. We're also putting out a lot of information. If any of you are familiar with the AFBF website, we have a market intel series where we basically put out economic information. We did a short little deep dive into the cattle markets, trying to explain, you know, short, like a pretty short read, factual, here's what's going on some of our efforts. So with that, I think I'll hand it back over to the moderator.
Thank you, Mr. Nephew. We appreciate those good comments, and we look forward to getting some questions headed your way. And thank you for the terrific questions that have already been submitted. You can press zero and ask your question now. Make sure our representative has that, and we'll position that and get to as many of those as we can tonight. But I do have a first question I'd like to start with, and that question will be for President Boehning. President Boehning, what efforts have Texas Farm Bureau undertaken to ensure the concerns of Texas farmers and ranchers have been heard during this pandemic?
Well, thank you, Gary, and thanks for the speakers that have spoken, and really appreciate the information. At Texas Farm Bureau, we've engaged on many fronts, and some of them have been mentioned already by our speakers. We've helped with supply chain issues. We've talked about ag labor being available when it comes to the H-2A program, and as far as the money that's coming from the stimulus, we've worked on that. But more specifically, when it comes to Texas cattle producers, we've been in direct contact with the USDA and our congressional leaders to make sure that federal funding that is included in the Phase 3 stimulus is directed to the stocker and cow-calf operators. I mean, we know that those are the folks that got hit the hardest in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Just a couple of things that we've done. We led a letter to Secretary Sonny Perdue at USDA. We start talking about the $9.5 billion that was specifically for livestock and specialty crops. We want to make sure that's where the money goes, that it goes to the folks in the livestock industry. 25 other state farm bureaus across the nation signed on with us at that letter. So, you know, those are the things that we've been working on. It's you know, we're in trying times right now. I think that's an understatement. But those are the things we're working on. We're in contact with our members. We're listening to our members. We know their concerns, and those are the things that we're working on.
Thank you, President Boehning. Let's get started on some questions. I appreciate all that have come in, and we will assign those to speakers. If you have additional comments, if you were not asked to address that question, jump right in. We'd love to hear as many perspectives and comments as we can. I guess a first question for Dr. Anderson. Is it better to sell feeder steers that I own at 500 pounds now, or wait until 800 pounds due to the volatility in the market?
Oh boy, that jumped out right with the hard one. Well, I'm going to preface that with a couple of things. One is, I think it's really important to look at, you have a lot of grass. If you got a lot of grass, the calves are in good shape. If you're not already fighting some dry conditions like some folks in South Texas have been doing, then I think the opportunity is there to hold on to them. I never really liked to the idea of selling into a panic unless you just don't have a choice. I think that is going to be something a lot of people have done and are doing. So I think one of the things that's going to come out of this is more of us to do that. Some of our kind of seasonal patterns are likely to get sort of filed up through this as these effects ripple all the way through our markets. I think one of the things I would probably stress is, you know, the opportunity to be sort of nimble maybe you got some time to let things shake out, and if you don't need the grass for the cows, I think it's okay. One of the things I would say is I don't think I would wait too long. One of the things I do see in a lot of our local auctions is the bigger the calf. You know, once those calves hit about 800 pounds, the price really drops off somewhere. And so I would kind of be careful there. But, you know, waiting a little bit, if they're gaining and they're in good shape, and, you know, you can kind of wait this out a little bit and see. We've certainly seen lower prices in the last couple of weeks for the calves, and you know, it's a tough call, I think, but, you know, I have a hard time, you know, I kind of hate to just jump out and sell when there's sort of a panic move underfoot, you know, and maybe we can get some time for some of this to kind of shake out a little bit with where we get some rising head cattle prices and kind of see, give it a little time to see what happens. You know, we did some computer decision aids, looked at some of these prices. You know, if you were thinking about trying to hold on to them, you know, to try to recoup some losses, you might realize it's pretty tough to do that. But we also did that about 2 weeks ago, and prices have come down significantly. So, you know, I think, you know, there, you know, I think it's a tough decision, but I think it's okay to hang on if you want to.
Very good. I appreciate that. Scott Bennett, I believe this next question may be in your area. Why can we not get rid of captive supplies, and why do we not have mandatory price reporting across the board?
So I guess I can answer the mandatory price reporting aspect of that. And this, you know, it when it rains, it pours, right? So the mandatory price reporting reauthorization comes about. It's reauthorized every 5 years. Mandatory price reporting will be reauthorized at the end of September 2020. That's when it expires. You know, all things on the sideline without the COVID-19 pandemic, I think it's fair to say that the House and Senate Ag Committees were set to address mandatory price reporting, you know, before 1st of May. That's not going to happen now, but that was set to, you know, those discussions among industry trade associations had been happening, and we had discussed with those ag committees, you know, getting behind some of mandatory price reporting reauthorization of work for everyone, and we move forward. This is going to really throw a wrench into the way we look at mandatory price reporting, mainly due to the fact that there's so much additional volatility. We've seen it. We saw it after Holcomb. We're seeing it now. And, you know, it's essentially back to the drawing table as far as I'm concerned, not to mention the political will of these. I mean, of course, it has to be reauthorized before September, right? The closer we get to the end of September without a reauthorized mandatory price reporting, the more volatile you could potentially see these markets because of that uncertainty. I think, you know, once Congress comes back and there's some sense of normalcy, if there is such a thing in Washington, D.C., you know, I think the House and Senate Ag Committees are going to look at this mandatory price reporting reauthorization and say, you know, look, folks, what do we need to change, and what needs to happen here so that we can mitigate, you know, some of these pickles we're in. I mean, not that mandatory price reporting can solve those problems, but they sure could alleviate it. We will be on the front lines on that very topic. We have been from the beginning. As someone who lives and works in Washington, D.C. every day, I can tell you that the staff at Texas Farm Bureau knock on my door constantly. They're in Washington, and they get it. They work this issue. and they know the concerns of the membership there in Texas. And we will work hand in hand not only with other state farm bureaus and as American Farm Bureau as a whole, but with other trade associations in our industry to see what can potentially change, what needs to stay the same, and how that can benefit price discovery moving forward as mandatory price reporting needs to be reauthorized by the end of this fiscal year.
Hey, Scott, this is David Anderson. Could I make a comment along with that, if that's okay with our moderator?
Of course.
I think you make some great points on mandatory price reporting, and that question is a really good one. I think it's, you know, with all this market volatility, with the potential of really changing sales of beef and of cattle as we move from this retail to grocery stores and all of this mess rippling through our market. I think one of the things, I'm going to throw out an idea. I think it would be a great idea to ask the Secretary to use whatever authority he has to waive the confidentiality rule for mandatory price reporting. I think that's something that certainly is in other livestock industries because I'll say what it is, because of lamb, they have to go bankrupt last week, and it was all due to the nail in the coffin was for all their sales, retail restaurant sales going up. The loss of that packer means we don't have any prices reported. And those prices being reported are critical for a free and competitive market to work. And I think we run the risk of having the same problem on the cattle side going forward. And to me, this is a real crisis. I think that would be something that the Secretary could do even temporarily to get us through this time of this extreme market volatility. I think that would help a lot with ensuring that we're getting prices reported so that for everybody in the market, that would be, I think, an important consideration and worth. I think that'd be worth doing. So I'm going to throw out an idea that that's what you're dealing with. So hopefully I didn't make anything harder on you, but that's just an idea from me anyway.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. I appreciate that, and I look forward to entertaining that and seeing if there's a possibility there. Thank you.
Mr. Bennett, while we have you, I think I have an additional question. You mentioned earlier that you've been in touch with packers. What has been the response of packers when they've been questioned about the spread in prices?
So I'll preface this with the statement that I'm not a professional economist at all. They know what their packer margin is, right? Michael Nephew put a market intel out last week that said it probably crept up close to $550 a head. It's come crashing back down since. They know their margin. They also know that their workforce is I'm not going to say unreliable, but boy, they're spooked by this coronavirus. And I'll kind of talk anecdotally here for a moment. When this first came about, there was about a 10% reduction, and this comes from my continual conversations with the packers. There's about a 10% reduction in their workforce showing up. And largely that was due to the fact that schools had closed, right? And we had people needing to stay home with their children. Another thing that I think is important for folks to realize in the packing industry is this workforce, there is such a labor demand in these packing plants that I can quit today, and in 5 days, if I want my job back, I can get it. They are that desperate for labor that the hand is in that of the worker. So there's concern. There was a 10% reduction initially. As the concern for this COVID-19 spread has exacerbated, we've seen the soldered in plant shut down. I know the Grand Island JBS plant is about 50% capacity due to an outbreak of COVID-19 there among the workforce. You know, these folks are getting a little spooked. The packer knows where they are, but the main thing is these plants have to remain open. I mean, they just have to. It's throughput, regardless the margin, because the moment that throughput stops, the folks in the heartland, right, the cow-calf folks, these stockers and backgrounders and folks lower on the supply chain than the packer, all of a sudden, their market evaporates zero. And that's not good for anyone. I think we need to focus on keeping the packer abreast, keeping them functioning and offering throughput, even at a reduced capacity. We are limping along, and you know that's not even to mention the pork and the chicken packing industries, where if you compare the salaries and the income of the three proteins, a beef line worker is going to make more than a pork line worker that's going to make more than a chicken line worker. You get into the Southeast where there's a lot of these chicken plants, it is dire. These folks are walking off out of concern. There's also concern that the unemployment situation, the unemployment benefits from this CARES package could benefit a line worker to essentially incentivize them to stay off the job. That it's imperative that that not happen. I encourage you all to work with Texas Farm Bureau and your governors so that it's not interpreted that if I'm laid off by a packing plant and then I go and get unemployment, and I see that check, and if it's bigger than the one I was making at the packing plant, there's no incentive to return back to work, and that is not beneficial for any part of the supply chain. We need to make sure that folks are interpreting this in a way where folks are incentivized to go back to work. And I think that's one that could potentially really slip up on this industry and catch us. I hope that's not the case. Texas Farm Bureau and American Farm Bureau have been working diligently to keep that from happening, but it's one worth mentioning as an additional variable as we look at exactly what's happening in this marketplace.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next question, hey, I believe. Dr. Anderson, I'll go right ahead. Jump right in.
Sorry, this is Michael. I just wanted to follow up on something Scott was saying just to keep myself clear. Some of what he was mentioning about the live to cutout spread, I do want to emphasize that $521, it's not necessarily margins or profit. It's really just the calculated value of the product that they're receiving minus their input. It's not taking into account labor. It's not taking into account overhead, rent, any of that. So it is important to keep in mind it's a rough estimate of the general healthiness of margins. And, you know, there's no way around it. They really are exceedingly healthy at this point. And they are on the way back down somewhat.
Next question for Dr. Anderson or Mr. Nephew. Ranchers are independent and have always been that way. They've never used USDA programs in the past. What are their options if they need to participate now?
Hey, Dr. Anderson, this is Michael. I figure that's a bit more policy, so
you're going to keep calling to me, aren't you?
Yeah. For those listening, I already made a pact with Dr. Anderson to just pass them all the hard questions, but this one's fairly easy because, you know, as Scott mentioned, we don't really know the details of the package at this point. So as of now, we know the general funding limits, that 9.5 to the secretary, that $14 billion going to CCC authority. There's some talk about trying to make sure livestock could be eligible for the CCC authority, but at this point, we don't fully know what these programs are going to look like. We don't know how the payments, however that's going to look like as it's structured by USDA, is going to look. So at this point, we don't necessarily have that, you know, go to farmers.gov website. We don't quite have that. But we can guarantee you that AFDF, and I'm willing to guarantee you the folks at Texas Farm Bureau, once we get that information, that we will be a resource for that. So once, again, USDA finally makes the determination there, your folks at Texas Farm Bureau and your folks at AFDF are going to be putting out that information as quickly as we can. This is something that, you know, our phones have been ringing off the hook, and we know it's coming down the pipeline, and we're going to be on top of it.
You know, I would add to
Nick,
that,
so go ahead.
There's a lot of work going on in terms of quantifying what those damages are, how a program might be put together to help ranchers. You know, typically farm programs are run through FSA. You know, we have a lot of ranchers in Texas anyway who have experience with FSA because of the LFP program and stuff out of the drive. And also stuff out of the hurricanes and things. So, you know, I think in some ways we have a lot of ranchers in our state that are a little more familiar with some of that than would be in some other states simply because of, you know, the 2011 and 12 and 13 drought. You know, we at least have a little bit, I think people have some more experience there, at least knowing where to go and where to start. And I think we'll see more out of this coming in the future as to, you know, what type of dollars we'll be talking about as this, you know, as this crisis fully unfolds.
Okay, gentlemen, I'll ask this question of all of you. Someone might want to go first. It's close to where their area of expertise. We're going to be talking about the expanded requirement for margins in accounts with the CME. And how does that limit a producer's ability to manage risk? Or more appropriately, does it reduce a rancher's ability to manage risk because it's costing them more with every market swing? The disconnect of boxed beef has been spreading for years now. How do we get fundamental trading back into the CME now that it's completely computer and technical trading?
Oh, boy. I don't know. Boy, the questions have gotten harder and harder. It's an excellent question. You know, if you guys don't, I'll take a shot at this first. You know, certainly bigger swings in the market, more volatility certainly makes, if you're using futures anyway, it certainly makes risk management more expensive. You know, but more volatility does make things more expensive anyway. And so, you know, it is true that it does make things more expensive. It certainly makes options more expensive if you were using options instead of futures directly. And so that volatility is there, and as it is in the whole rest of the economy right now. So I think it does make it more expensive. And you know, certainly in the futures market, if we looked at where, you know, feeder cattle are today, well, it sure doesn't look like much of a hedging or a hedging opportunity. And so I think it's often the case that, you know, we might have a futures market, but the prices that are there sure don't look very good and lean us more towards not doing any risk management in that area anyway. You know, if we went back to January, prices looked really, really good, and I'm afraid not enough people try to take advantage of those. But that's certainly a case of volatility that makes risk management more expensive. It might also make it more critical that we do something. So that's my shot of an answer.
Anybody else?
I was going to say, I don't think I can do any better than Dr. Anderson just did.
The reason really for our call tonight, COVID-19 and the impacts on all of agriculture, but tonight particularly we're discussing the cattle industry. And I guess, Mr. Methew, what do things look like for the cattle business in 3 to 4 years, looking at how terribly the coronavirus has impacted the cattle industry?
You know, one of the things that I'm more interested in, maybe Dr. Anderson has some thoughts on this, but sorry to throw you under the bus, but one of the things I'm more focused on at this point is the current shift from food service to retail and how we're trying to figure that out. You look back at that spike in the cutout that we saw, you know, a week ago, 2 weeks ago. It's been coming down a little bit since then, still way above where it was. Most of that was not driven by your more valuable middle meat purchases that we're used to. That was all driven by the round the chuck. Consumers were stocking up their freezers with ground beef, economical cuts, roasts, things that, you know, they're trying to buy a lot of it to put in their freezer, they're going to buy the cheaper cuts. That's interesting to me. You saw actually like the tenderloin itself, one of the most expensive cuts, drop dramatically. That's because that's so reliant upon that food service demand channel. So to me, you know, looking out into the future, I don't know if this is a reckoning, a wake-up call, but trying to figure out how quickly we can switch from one to the other, I think it's going to be really interesting to figure out how beef demand plays in the future. Because again, you know, it's hard to figure out exact numbers on how much beef goes into the food service, institutional restaurant, you know, the school lunch program versus the retail sector. But we as Americans have been trending towards that food away from home dollars. And retailers, as their grocery stores were sold out, you saw all these pictures floating around on social media of empty grocery shelves, meat cases that had nothing in it altogether. I think Dr. Aniston mentioned people were buying up all the gizzards and livers trying to just get their hands on that animal protein. I think consumers didn't really fully realize that there wasn't a food shortage issue in America. This is purely a logistical supply chain issue while the plants are still running. That's something that how does the industry manage that shift in the future, I think is going to be a really interesting answer.
Hey, Mike, I'm going to add one thing, if it's okay with you and our moderator. This is David.
Please.
I'll tell you, my long-term view on the cattle industry hasn't changed, even though we have these pretty darn scary times, and that is I'm an optimist on the cattle industry and the cattle market and our prospects longer term in the future. We've had the last 4 or 5 years of growing domestic demand. Our consumers want beef. But not only that, they want a higher quality beef. And we've been delivering that with increasing amounts of choice and prime. Our export markets are growing. I think those basic prospects for demand, I think it leaves me pretty optimistic. I think it also, you know, certainly our cattle herd peaked last year and has been coming down. And, you know, I think the herd will continue to decline because we're still in a cyclical industry. But, you know, I really think while these are scary times and we're going to sort through a lot of stuff between restaurant and grocery store purchases and how we get through this. Longer term, I have to say, even as an economist, I'm optimistic on the cattle market and the cattle industry longer term.
I can't agree more. That is absolutely true. I'm 100% bullish on animal protein, especially on a long-term trajectory. Thank you.
Mr. Bennett, a question for you. USDA is formulating how funding will be available for ranchers. Where do we watch for that updated information? Where would you suggest?
Well, I would encourage you, that this is the easiest answer because stay in touch with Texas Farm Bureau. They're on the battlefront of this issue, and Texas Farm Bureau is going to get you the answer faster than anyone in Texas. But as far as when that may come, this is uncharted territory, and we haven't seen a program like this put together for some time, or ever, quite frankly, for the livestock industry. This industry is one where we typically reserve away from a government payment or a government payment. And here's an opportunity, here's a time where things are so dire that it's necessary. So USDA is having to come up with how this is going to be constructed. There's no template. There's no skeleton for what this could look like. They're working on that. And again, at American Farm Bureau, we are encouraging them to move as fast as possible, but at the same time balancing their the speed of which people get remedied for their loss with an equitable and common sense approach, and one that takes into play all of the sectors of the livestock industry, of the cattle industry, the cattle or the cow-calf folks, the backgrounders, the stockers, the feeders, and having something that makes sense to all of them. But the simple and short answer to that is Texas Farm Bureau. Thanks.
To our two economists on the call tonight, due to drastic volatility in livestock and dairy markets, do you see a crash in feed commodity prices?
I think we're headed for, this is David Anderson, I think we are headed for lower feed costs also. I mean, if we look at, you know, how many acres of corn and soybeans are going to be planted this year, we look at this, the falling gas prices that nobody's driving around anyway, so it cuts into our ethanol demand. That has helped a lot of corn farmers and hurt lots of livestock people over time, but the, you know, as we look at that going forward on the demand side, and on the supply side, growing supplies and reduced demand, I think we're headed for even lower prices on the feed side, which I think is, you know, I think is something we ought to be watching for to help our calf prices in the fall is lower feed costs. But regardless of that, you know, I think we're headed for lower prices across the board throughout. I think a lot of agriculture. We've certainly got, and again, related to this whole shifting restaurant to grocery stores. I mean, I think we've all seen the pictures in the news of dairy farmers having to dump milk, vegetable growers harvesting crop that basically they had to pick, but they just, they have to dump it on the ground. There's, you know, the price they would get for it is zero, or cost you more to harvest it than you're going to get out of it. So, you know, I think all of agriculture, we've had a bunch of, I think, some pretty damn tough years over the last handful of years, and I think we're headed for another pretty damn tough year out of this too, throughout agriculture.
This is Michael. I think I'd probably echo a lot of what Dr. Anderson just said. You look at balance sheet and all the demand sources for corn. I really appreciate him highlighting ethanol because that is just, I mean, I know livestock's taking it in the teeth, dairy's having a real tough time, particularly in the spot markets, but ethanol is also another one of those industries that's just getting hammered. I think I've seen less than 4 billion gallons of ethanol volume been idled, and what that translates to in corn demand, yeah, you're going to have a lot of corn out there looking for a home. And on top of that, with USDA's prospective planting report, huge amount of corn potentially going to be planted. And before the trade war started, before COVID-19 started, we were already sitting on a mountain of corn. So I think that's just going to exacerbate itself, and you're going to still continue to see those low corn prices moving forward. Potentially something else to keep in mind, more ethanol plants that are shuttered, idled, you're going to see less DDGs coming out of them. It's real difficult to switch up a feeding program in the middle of it. I think that's going to cause a lot of disruption that way. And also, just a little touch on, not necessarily on the feed side, but another impact of the ethanol plant shuttering, it could eventually have supply chain disruptions for beef, particularly in the pork side as well, is how much CO2 produced by those ethanol plants is utilized by the food processing and packing sector. What do you think runs the stun guns? That's going to be CO2. So if you start seeing the shortage of that, it's going to make it more difficult for the, again, just another, all of agriculture is dealing with this, but it's just another supply chain disruption on top of everything else we've already seen.
Thank you very much. Some excellent questions being submitted. We appreciate everybody that's pressed zero and submitted their question to our Texas Farm Bureau representatives that are on the phone. Really good. And this question kind of trends us towards futures markets. Mr. Depew, maybe this is closer to your area. What is the role of the algorithmic traders, and what kind of impact do they have on the volatility within the futures market?
You know, Dr. Anderson, I think I can probably try and take a swing at one of the hard questions since I've been taking them all to you.
I was hoping.
You know, I think that's his way of saying that I don't think either of us is going to give a real satisfactory answer. This is one where it's really hard to fully prove what the full impact of the algorithmic trading is. That's one where, I mean, you want my opinion? Yes, the increase in algorithmic high-frequency trading has done nothing but add more volatility to the market. It's really made it difficult for your average producer to compete. You have producers, especially you talk about the rural broadband issue, operating with much slower internet connections, putting in resting stop orders. It's going to be just terribly complicated to try and compete with these high frequency traders who are operating all on these algorithm side of things. So I 100% agree that's done nothing but add volatility to the market. Now, I don't, and I know this is not going to really be the full answer anybody's looking for, but I don't know what the answer is myself. I don't know, Dr. Anderson, if you have something in mind. This is something that you... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, again, at AFBS level, this is something we talked to CFTC. My boss, Dr. John Newton, incredibly smart, talented guy, really knowledgeable in the futures markets, has had a lot of conversations with the folks at CFTC about what actions they can be taking in terms of ways to mitigate that volatility coming in through the high-frequency and algorithmic traders. But go ahead, Dr. Anderson.
I will add a couple of things to that. You know, it's certainly, you know, I think we have to argue, common sense would tell us it's added to volatility. Where we have that kind of trading, instantaneous trading, you know, we're left with nobody on the other side to make a trade. You know, people, you know, nobody's going to stand in front of a freight train coming. And so where we used to have people doing the trading, we used to have folks who would make the market. We had buyers and sellers. You look at some of what we have, like, you know, lately we've had nothing but sellers, you know, basically, you know, driving the price down. And nobody's taking the other side because, you know, nobody's going to do that. And there's nobody's going to market anymore who plays that function, who fills that role. And you know, I have to believe that has been detrimental to our markets. And I'll go a little further and find out. Because, and I think this is just a fact. It's just, you know, not to point fingers at anyone, but, you know, I don't think that's going to change. And that's because, you know, the market is a profit-making entity. They make money because there is no trading. And so I don't think, I'm hard-pressed to ever see any rules come around or to believe that any rules are going to come around that's going to limit volume, they're going to limit trading, because that's, you know, just like cutting off your nose to spite your face if you're the exchange, because that's how they make money and that's what allows that market to be in place. And so, you know, I think it's one of these things where I think it is certainly detrimental to our markets. But I'm hard pressed to see it change.
We know how important the Conservation Reserve Program is to Texas and Texas landowners, producers. Mr. Bennett, is the USDA considering to open up emergency CRP grazing earlier this year due to the emergency market scenario?
Yeah, thank you. This has been an issue that's been raised by people all across the country, and that is, you know, opening up CRP land for cattle grazing. It's a simple solution to you know, a complex issue that we have. I know a lot of the theater folks that, you know, especially these or the potential that these plants really scale down, you know, as these feedlots fill up, they're going to need places to go with their cattle. As the DDG situation becomes more complex and it's either harder to get or too expensive, those cattle need to be fed on something. That CRP land is one that could be an answer. Fortunately, the answer to this question is of whether or not we can open up CRP. It's not a statutory fix, which means Congress does not have to include this in a bill. It can be done at USDA through the regulatory process, and it is something that American Farm Bureau will take a hard look at as a potential relief valve for folks that need that little bit of extra relief, turn cattle out on CRP, and have them graze that while the situation settles down.
Mr. Bennett, let's stay with you for another question. How fair, if it's been fair at all, in the way MFP payments have been to cattle producers?
So, and Michael, I'll ask for you to back me up here. To my knowledge, MFP has not been available to cattle producers for livestock losses. It was a program put in place by the Trump administration to mitigate losses by those on row crop, you know, folks growing row crops for the lack of trade, especially between China's lack of buying soybeans or corn. So we don't have a skeleton or that template, as I've mentioned earlier, on what MFP may look like for cattle. Here we now have this CARES Act passed, $24 billion sent to USDA. $9 billion of that is carved out of CCC replenishment, which means cattle producers have access to it. How much of that they get is still unknown, and how whatever percentage they do get is divvied up, we do not know. We are being advocates for, you know, both sides of that coin, right? We need livestock producers to have an equitable amount of that money, and then once we know what that dollar amount is, it needs to be divided in a manner that is fair to all sectors of livestock. You know, again, from the cow-calf folks, the part-time farmers, 30 to 50 head, you know, they have a job in town. Here they all of a sudden take calves to the market and they realize that they're in a dire situation. At that point in time, they should be, you know, their losses should be mitigated by the government. And you have to remember, too, these are those producers that have or that typically don't utilize any risk management strategies just due to the scale of their operation. So we can't really use MFP as too much of a template just because that's more of a crop side equation, but we are working with USDA to make sure they have all the tools necessary to make sure every sector of the cattle industry is equally represented in how they are paid or how they are compensated from this $9 billion from USDA through the CARES Act.
And since Scott went ahead and called me out, I'll add a little bit of color commentary around that. Not necessarily just the MFP, because beef did not get to participate in the MFP program. But if you think back to when this originally happened after the trade war started, there was a whole trade aid package beyond just MFP. So there was also the food purchase and distribution program. Again, beef didn't really get a huge share of that. They actually were pretty small. I think 14.8 million or so Port largely benefited more from that, as well as Port got to participate in the actual merchant facilitation program payments. At the risk of putting my head in the lines out on this one, I'll also put out that the COVID thing is not MFP. Beef is going to be impacted by COVID. This is a demand issue at the U.S. level. With MFP, honestly, beef escapes much of the trade war. Beef, somewhat unscathed. Our top export markets are not China or Mexico. The top export market is Japan. Beef actually had record exports during the trade war. This is something where beef is... We got to focus on the COVID situation as something completely different and not think about it as an MFP situation. This is something where beef really will be impacted more than some of these other animal proteins. And beef is going to be impacted a lot more than many of these row crops. This is something, again, you got to think about it as a divorce situation that we need to really focus on its own solution and not think about it as a template about MFP.
All right, very good. We were talking about beef demand and some of those changes. Let's focus on the lost restaurant sales because of COVID-19 and some of the protocols in place. What does that represent in terms of lost market in particular for cattle producers?
I said it to you, Dr. Anderson, and he knows more than I do, so.
Oh, no. I will take a shot. We'll tag team this thing.
Yes, sir.
You know, I think it's one of the things I think it would help all of us if we look, you know, beyond just that cutout, that box beef cutout value that is, it simply says kind of the value of the carcass, the value of all those primal cuts. And so, you know, it's got chucks and rounds and loins and rib, brisket. And so if we dig in a little deeper and look at some of the wholesale cut prices, it's very clear what is what's more affected and more impacted by the restaurant collapse versus this grocery store boom, if you will, or CD. And so if we take a look at some of those wholesale cut values, I think, Michael, I think you mentioned this before, but stuff like the ribeyes, the fillets, those prices have collapsed. And then you put it on a chart, and it immediately makes me think that I've got a typo. I mean, those markets have collapsed. You think about it, a good steakhouse or a place where you're going to go get a steak. Those places are closed down or trying to make it by takeout. If we look at some other things, the chuck, the 90% lean ground beef, those things are actually going up in value. They're above where we were a year ago, in fact. And that's because you're thinking about recession. What are people going to buy? They're going to buy hamburgers. They're going to buy ground beef. They're going to buy other value-based or cheap stuff. They're going to buy chicken. They're going to buy ground beef. They're going to buy some pork items, too. But, you know, we see the 90% lean going up. In fact, that supported the whole cow market. The one kind of significant bright spot paper has been that. But we see chucks that, you know, we make roasts. We grind them into ground chuck. You know, so you see the rounds, the chucks, the 90% lean going up. We see the steaks declining in value dramatically. We also see the stuff like the 50% lean ground beef. There's a lot of what we might see in food service has a little higher fat lean fat content. That price has collapsed. In fact, there's some been told anecdotally that there have been some 50 leans that have actually gone into the rendering fat because they just don't have, there's just not enough value there left. We're talking like 25 cents a pound for 50 lean. That's 50% lean is not something you see in the grocery store. But when you make a lean to fat mix that gets you to 80-20 or you know, 73-27. So very clearly see, you know, these changing wholesale market values in the cuts. And unfortunately for us, the high value stuff, the steaks, that's, those are being hurt dramatically by the restaurant trade. And so, you know, that's the high value end stuff that's really going to drag down, as this goes on, drag down the value of what we're producing, because we're losing the middle meats, we're losing the value in the high end cuts. And we could draw similar conclusions about, if we looked at some chicken cuts and some pork cuts as well, that it's very clear what's most dominated by food service, because those prices are falling fast, and what's dominated by grocery stores, because we actually see some support for prices there. And so I think this is a prime opportunity to really, you know, kind of take a look at some of those, and maybe expand a little bit from the live animals, but take a look at some of those markets, and that's where I think it really brings it home to me anyways, what cuts are really at risk in our restaurant sector.
You know, not sure how much tag teaming I can do, because I feel like you just gave a really good answer, but just to add a little bit more onto that, you know, I've been seeing everything he just said accurate. I've also been seeing even some reports on the select side of some bids for your tenderloin coming in below a New York strip. Outside of the beef side, there's been reports of pork bellies going to rendering. These are heavily reliant upon that food service. I mentioned earlier that the tenderloin cut has dropped dramatically since this, and that's typically one of the most valuable cuts that you're going to have out of the cutout. That is just, again, to echo everything you said, everything tied to extreme food service demand, you've seen a negative price reaction. I know a lot of people are frustrated by the spike in the cutout, but what's really driving that is those economical cuts that consumers are stocking up on in their freezers, like we mentioned earlier. That food service versus retail split, again, it's going to be real interesting to see how they can move forward in the future. And also mention, and I think Scott alluded to this a little bit earlier, is this idea of consumers panic bought. They keep putting meat in the freezer. Those freezers are going to get full. After a little bit, we're going to come back down into a situation where there's not a panic buying situation, and you know you might see some of that reflected at the retail case. At least where I'm at, you know, anecdotal evidence, backyard trading, my Harris Teeter, I miss HEB, but I got Harris Teeter set up here. Whenever I go over there, the meat case is already back to normal, pretty much. The only thing in my store really missing is toilet paper at this point. There was a week or two where it was a little bit tricky to try and find some stuff. Chicken thighs were hard to find. Ground beef was hard to find. But steaks were still there. I also mentioned the retail features. USDA puts out this report on basically what are the ad campaigns being run by all the stores and what cuts of meat are they being run on. You saw for most products, especially food products, the stores didn't need to run ads. I mean, they were moving the product. It was flying off the shelves. They had no reason to run anything. But you know what the ads are still running on? They're running it on ribeyes. They're running it on tenderloins. They're running it on actual fancy, nice, high-value cuts of meat, because that's what they can't move into food service. That's what they have a surplus of right now.
I think we're going to see a lot of specials come Memorial Day.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. We have reached the end of our Texas Farm Bureau Tele-Town Hall. Thank you, Dr. David Anderson, Mr. Scott Bennett, Mr. Michael Nephew, for your excellent responses, your good insights. And thank you for all of our participants for your excellent questions.
Gary, this is Russell. I got one quick question or comment for Dr. Anderson. I think that will kind of try to help tie this together. Is that all right, or am I on, Gary?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
You know, Dr. Anderson said something early on in his opening, and maybe a little light went on in my head back when I was in an ag eco class in that great ag school on the Brazos River. But he used a word called uncertainty, and I'd like for Dr. Anderson to expand on that just a little bit from both the demand side and the supply side, and I think if we all just step back for a minute and realize the situation that we're in right now, that word uncertainty, I think, has a lot to do with what's going on. Dr. Anderson, would you, or anybody else, would you care to expand just a little bit?
I'll give it a shot. And thanks for asking. We could give some technical things, and you know, a lot of times we might define uncertainty as, you know, risk we can define as, you know, there's a probability of something happening, and we have some historical precedent to go on, so we know what the odds are. If anybody likes to go to the craps table, we know what the odds are, right? Or at the blackjack table. You know, to use that kind of example. Uncertainty is, you know, we don't have anything to go on. And it's unprecedented. That uncertainty forces us into a place we haven't been to before. And I think this is to me, a classic example of that. But the thing is, we still have to act. We still have to do something. We still have to make the best call we can do, the best judgment we can to deal with these uncertain times. And so, you know, I think, you know, if I was going to, I'll probably tend to a little bit rely here on the demand side of this. When I think about uncertainty, you know, roughly 70% of our economy is all of us consumers spending money, buying stuff. And, you know, we get in a time like this, we get in the Great Recession more than a decade ago, and one of the things that can happen is, you know, not only these uncertain times, but uncertainty brings a lot of fear, too, and it's scary for a lot of people. And, you know, I think the key for the economy going forward is how do we come out of this? When do we come out of it? But also, how do we come out of this? Are we frozen with fear and we don't spend any money? And 70% of our economy is based on all of us spending money, and that's what creates jobs. That's what creates all the jobs at the restaurants and all the stores in town and all the places that we go. And it's going to be, you know, how we come out of this is going to rely a heck of a lot on how we all respond. And uncertainty creates that fear. And yet we still have to act. And so, you know, I think that, you know, uncertainty to me is a really great word, because these are times, this is something really none of us have been through before. You know, and some things are, you know, some things that we see happening make a lot of sense. Yeah, that's what we ought to expect to have happen, but there's a lot of other things, not just in uncharted territory. And I think for all of us who are part of this American economy, you know, how we react to this is pretty critically important as to how long this goes on, at least this recession goes on, and how we come out of it. So, you know, thinking from a demand, an income, a gross domestic product kind of thing, that's pretty important. You know, on the supply side, you know, particularly for, you know, in agriculture, we got a bunch of assets that we're making productive stuff with. And we already have calves on the ground for lots of us. And we've got something to sell. And so so within all this market uncertainty, there are some things we can still control. We can try to control our costs. We can take care of things on the ranch. We can do those things that are our normal seasonal practice that we do to produce a good product for sale in that market come the fall, or whenever we normally sell. And so, you know, a little bit on the production side, which is really the supply side, there is a little bit of normal driven by the seasons, driven by rain, driven by, you know, sun shining on the grass. And there's some things we can control beyond this big old uncertain market and this uncertain economy. So I think, you know, that's sort of my shot at an answer, and I'd welcome somebody else's shot at an answer, too.
Can't think of a better answer.
I'm good with that, Gary.
I'm glad you brought that up. Excellent point, excellent question. And with that, President Boehning, your chance to offer any closing thoughts.
Well, just you already kind of started it, Gary, but I want to tell you that I appreciate everyone's efforts tonight, especially our speakers, Dr. Anderson and Scott Bennett, Michael Nephew. Appreciate you guys being on the line and helping us kind of sort through this. Gary, I want to thank you and our entire Texas Farm Bureau staff for your efforts tonight and even before tonight, because I know it took a while to do this, our first teletown hall, so to speak. You know, we started off talking about questions that we had about the beef and cattle markets. You know, what is happening? But I guess more importantly, why is it happening? And what can we anticipate as we go forward? And I think our questions revolved around that. I think we had some great questions. Hopefully that we shed some light on it for everybody that had the questions and everybody that was on the call. I enjoyed the discussion. I got a lot of notes written down, and I know I learned a lot, and have some more things to follow up on. We're all feeling the serious impacts of things that are going on during these difficult times. And we think it's important that we try to stay informed. We try to stay educated about what's going on. But it's also important that we base our actions and any solutions that we think we might have on facts. And hopefully we got some more of those facts tonight, and we can go forward with that. As we close, this is our first Teletown Hall. Please let us know how you think we did. And if you thought the event was worthwhile, we value your feedback. Again, thank everyone on the line that participated. Thank everyone for calling, and whether you had a question or not, thank you for being here. With that being said, Gary, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, President Boehning. And in fact, we do have your first chance to provide feedback. There's a nice polling feature on our Teletown Hall, and we'll use that right now with one question for your response. You'll use your phone's keypad to respond. The question is, did tonight's Teletown Hall provide useful information and was beneficial to you? If yes, please press 1. If no, please press 2. I'll repeat the question. Did tonight's Teletown Hall provide useful information and was it beneficial to you? If yes, please press 1. If no, please press 2. I'll give everyone a few seconds to complete the response. This does conclude the Texas Farm Bureau Teletown Hall. Thank you for joining. To learn more about these issues and other topics associated with the COVID-19 pandemic, please go to our Texas Farm Bureau website at txfb.org. Also, please know that a recording of tonight's event will be positioned on the website in the coming days. If you'd like to leave a question or comment, please stay on the line, and you will be automatically sent to a voicemail box. Please be sure to leave your name and contact information along with your comment. Have a good night, everyone.